We spend a lot of time researching, clicking around the internet for articles, blog posts, etc. on race and poverty and other just kind of like random stuff.
All work related.
All work related.
All work
sure.
related. Yeah. But there was that one with the baby polar bear.
Yeah, there was a the panda video.
Oh my God, the panda video.
Yes.
I mean, come on.
A reminder that if you want to keep up on what we're reading about, you can follow us on Twitter at We Live Here STL.
Right, but we digress.
Yeah, because we were doing some research about religion. It's the holidays, and we came across a blog post by this guy.
Hi, I'm Reverend Dan Schatz, the minister of the Bucksmont Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Warrington, Pennsylvania.
That's a suburb of Philadelphia.
So here's the story Reverend Dan tells in this blog post we read. It's about what happened to him a year ago when he put a Black Lives Matter sign out front of his church.
I received a letter at one point from somebody in the community upset that we had a sign stating that Black Lives Matter and asking that it be taken down and replaced with one that said All Lives Matter. And one of the things that was said in that letter was, since when has God chosen to see us by the color of our skin?
So Reverend Dan writes back that Black Lives Matter doesn't mean other lives don't, but you have to acknowledge African Americans are often targeted unfairly.
Many people, particularly people who have white privilege, like myself, kind of wanted to think that all of this was behind us and that we didn't have to worry about racism anymore. After all, Barack Obama is president, and many, many things have changed. But we had to confront realities that were profoundly uncomfortable. But, you know, I keep coming back to the message of love. It's that simple message that is in so many religions. It's in the Christian religion when you're talking about love your neighbors as yourselves. It's in the teachings of Rabbi Hillel in his statement of the Golden Rule. Don't do to others what's hateful to you. It's in the Buddhist teaching of loving kindness. I think that the most powerful motivator in this is that message of love. And love calls us to truly walk with people. And and it doesn't demand perfection, but it does demand presence, and it demands we show up.
On this episode, thoughts from religious leaders who do show up and talk about race with their congregations.
We live here.
A project exploring
race,
class,
power,
poverty,
systems, and the people they touch.
I'm Tim Lloyd.
And I'm Camille Stanley. And from St. Louis Public Radio, this is We Live Here.
Like we usually do, we were tweeting about getting ready to do this show, and Jason Callahan, who uses the Twitter handle at JCSTLSun, that's spelled S-U-N, replied with a link to a survey that was done by the Barna Group. Now, the Barna Group specializes in polls about faith and culture. Thanks, Jason, for shooting that survey our way. And in this survey, it found that 1 in 3 Americans say Christian churches are part of the problem when it comes to racism.
And that number goes up among young people. Nearly half of millennials say Christian churches fuel racial tensions. But here's the thing. In the same survey, there was an overwhelming majority of people who say Christian churches play a vital role in racial reconciliation.
Now, we're not experts in religion or theology.
So we did what reporters do and found one, a spirit guide, if you will.
Yeah, see what we did there?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Leah Gunning Francis is Associate Dean of Contextual Education at Eden Theological Seminary in St. Louis. She recently wrote a book about faith leaders who joined the activist movement after Michael Brown's death in Ferguson.
And she is one of a handful of ministers who came into our studios recently to talk about the intersection of race and religion.
Out of the gate, we asked Leah the guiding question for this episode.
What is it about faith, about places of faith, that make these type of conversations so important?
The place of faith is supposed to be the place of sanctuary, the place of refuge, the place of wholeness, the place of healing. And so where better place than to talk about one of the prevailing issues that has just deeply dehumanized so many for so long and denied a sense of full humanity and wholeness and healing. Because if we recall, you know, racial bias against African Americans is inscribed in the U.S. Constitution. You know, that was sort of the foundational bedrock of what it means to be Black and partially human in the United States of America. That's sort of played out in a variety of ways ever since then. And so I like to take this back to not just being a political issue, but a theological issue. Because whenever somebody says that any group of people is only 3/5 of a human being, they are also saying that that person is not fully created in the image of God. And so for me, in talking about it in churches, I always bring it back to what it means to be created in the image of God and what it means for all people to be understood to be created in the image of God.
You know, a lot of people who perpetuate racism are also consider themselves good Christians. So how does that ever come up when you're dealing with people who are trying to either separate those two things or kind of reconcile those two things, I guess is a better way to put it.
Absolutely. And the critical part of the work is helping with that reconciliation, that for pastors to have to help congregants understand that it's not just about what happens here in this church on a Saturday or Sunday or Friday, whenever your congregation worships, but how does it inform the rest of your week? How does it inform the rest of your interactions? How does it inform the decisions you make at work? How does it inform the decisions and things that you do in your recreation time? So, you know, there were members of the Ku Klux Klan that identified as very devout Christians. There's a long history in this country and globally as well of Christianity, especially being buttressed by racism, if you will. And so to have to continue to make the case that the life of faith and these ideas about race are not separate, but that they are intricately involved because God desires that all people understand that all are created in the image of God.
It would be negligent to not discuss things that are obvious.
That's Askia Hamid.
And I'm the resident imam at Masjid al-Mu'minun here in St. Louis.
What do conversations about race look like in your congregation?
You would hear the same concerns that you would hear in general in the African-American community. The thing is that we have to weigh it by the Quran. You know, far as our demeanor and spirit in which we deal with it. One of the references that is often used is that oppression is worse than slaughter. And this is something that you would hear in the international world too, when it's perceived, the realities that they face that can be seen as oppressive. And that it is worse than slaughter, this particular quote from the Quran. Well, I have one here I can read later, a verse that brings the balance to that, that not let others' wrongs to you cause you to do wrong in excess. Mm-hmm. You know, so the Muslim is responsible to not bring about injustice and hardship on others that are innocent as you seeking to seek justice for yourself. So these things help keep a balance.
We should note here that we asked Imam Hamid to recite for us a passage from the Quran that he felt supported his thoughts on race. You can hear that as well as what other pastors told us at our website, stlpublicradio.org. We'll also be tweeting about it from our handle. That's at WeLiveHereSTL.
Ooh, good promotion.
I do what I can.
All right. So like our spirit guide, Leah, Imam Hamid is African-American, and so are many of the people in his congregation.
This is notable because the religion he practices is actually one of the more racially diverse in the U.S.
Whites, Blacks, and Asians each make up a quarter or more of the nation's Muslim population. That's according to the Pew Research Center.
But Imam Hamid says, like other areas of society, people worship where they feel comfortable, and segregation creeps into churches and mosques.
Nevertheless, he says the Quran places a high value on diversity.
I'm using my words, but it's a reference in the Quran that Almighty God made us into nations and tribes that we might learn to know more about each other is knowledge in all of these cultures and experiences. So learning more about each other helps to expand all of our horizon.
Terrell Carter has spent much of his adult life crisscrossing that racial horizon. As a former cop, he's written about what it means to be a black police officer patrolling the streets of St. Louis, and he talks openly about the racism he faced at times from fellow officers.
Terrell is also a man of faith. These days, he's the first black pastor at the mostly white Webster Groves Baptist Church. He says race can be an issue no matter who is doing the talking or listening.
When my girlfriend, now wife, when we were dating and I was, you know, seeking opportunities to serve in churches, she would go with me and my grandmother would go as well. My sweet black grandmother would go almost like as a buffer.
Grandma could smooth out any right. awkward moments.
There you
because,
go.
Because she's white, right?
My wife is
yes.
white, yes.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
And so I remember specifically going to one church speaking in lieu of a call. And my grandmother, so in black churches, in general churches, when a person comes to speak, if they're a visitor or they're doing it in lieu of a call, then they have like a recessional line where everyone gets to come shake their hands, all those things. And when we had, it was time for the recessional line, my grandmother stood first. I have a two-year-old son from a prior marriage that I have custody of. I've raised him. I've had custody of him since he was two. So my wife has been in his life since he was, you know, 2 years old. So my grandmother, my son, my girlfriend, and then me. And people would walk up and they would shake my grandmother's hands. They would shake my son's hand, tell him how cute he was. They would look at my wife, not touch her at all, and then come to me. It took two people doing that, and I told my family, okay, we're leaving right now, because if they are comfortable doing this to you in front of me, there's no telling what else is going to happen, just in general. And my mm-hmm. point of bringing that story up is that these questions about race are not just in white churches, are in black churches as well. So your original question was, is it a challenge? Yes. I think that whether you're serving in a white church, black context, Hispanic, Korean, whatever, these are things that all congregations have to deal with. Some of us are able to deal with them a little more smoothly, while some of us are not. And some congregations just don't want to deal with it at all. I mean, again, I've served in white churches and black churches. And, you know, the thing that people want to avoid at all costs is a conversation about race and what that means.
Do you recall, like, when you were a kid and growing up in the church, that race was, if not explicitly talked about in church, but was part of the church experience?
It was always an underlying foundation of my church experience in the black church. It was just understood that white people did not like or respect black people. I say that, and one of my grandfathers was the pastor of a church for 23 years, and I grew up in that church. He did not trust white people. Neither one of my grandfathers trusted white people. They came from a different generation where they were called boy, where they were treated very disrespectfully, and that colored their life experiences. Now, as we've gotten older, as one of those grandfathers has passed, but the other one, as he's gotten older, as his family has changed, his family makeup has changed, because multiple, you know, relatives have married outside of their race, and he's had a chance to be in relationship with their spouses, his outlook has changed some. He still, though, does have some of the roots of separation about him. But from a child, my grandfather, the one who served as a pastor, a long-term pastor at one church, he talked about, you know, about how we couldn't trust white people, how, you know, the Bible was used to hold black people down, those kinds of things.
I just want to ask you quickly about your congregation in Webster. You had brought up that race is something that you don't feel like is off limits, obviously.
Right.
But you don't necessarily go out and say, you know, this coming Sunday is my race sermon.
Right.
So it almost seems like you're like normalizing the conversation. That's sort of your approach as a faith leader.
So for me, the normalization is we treat people the way God wants us to treat them, regardless of race or gender or anything else. The grace that God has shown each of us individually, we are obligated to show to everyone else as well. And so, no, I don't have to say, here goes my race sermon next Sunday, because every Sunday periodically, or as it comes up through whatever it is we're studying or speaking about, we are able to talk about that. So the one thing I did do when I was called to be pastor at Webster Groves is I took the first 5 weeks to intentionally preach a series that dealt with seeing people as God sees them, regardless of anything. So regardless of race again, gender, or anything else. And so that was my way of doing an intentional series about it. And with that as the foundation, we continue to go back to the idea that we have to treat people, everyone, the way that God wants.
Remember Spirit Guide Leah? She says even when faith leaders feel like they should talk about race, some don't, because the stakes are just too high, even for Black pastors.
I often wonder if for some, they don't feel like they can take the risk of being ostracized. If you look at what's happened so often with people like Reverend Jesse Jackson or Reverend Al Sharpton, in the media, they are always often castigated as race baiters or race agitators, when the truth of the matter is what they do is seek to bring to the public's attention issues of racial injustice. All of the people that I talk with feel very strongly about having these conversations, especially the white clergy people that I talk to. Many of them describe their work, and the crux of their work is waking up white people to racism.
Maharat Rory Pickernice, a female Jewish member of the clergy, says she also found herself wanting to wake up people in the pews. So last year, shortly after Michael Brown's death, she decided to use her own pulpit.
Tell me about when you tried to bring up race in Temple.
I always think that part of my role being in the clergy and when I was working in a congregation was always to try to talk about whatever was going on in the world. I just don't think that our faith is about reading old texts, but it has to be about what we're living today. I would get up on the pulpit, and I would say, these are the issues of our time. And some people really loved that I gave voice to it, and some people really didn't like it. And the people who didn't like it largely stood silent or complained to the rabbi that I worked with or complained to other people.
Can you tell us a little bit about your congregation, who they are?
So the congregation, which now I'm actually no longer serving, now I'm a member of, the congregation is a pretty eclectic group of people, many of whom are connected with universities, so a lot of academic backgrounds, highly intellectual, really engaged in the world, really passionate about social justice. And so on some level, it never even occurred to me to hesitate when
I was going to ask about that. I mean, it seems like those are the kind of folks who, you know, if I can just throw out my own stereotype, who you would think would be okay with having these type of conversations.
Yeah, and that's why it never even caused me any pause to think that I could get up and say these things. And it's why I didn't really pause. It's only really after the fact that I look back and think, oh, maybe that was a little bit gutsy, or maybe I should have run that by a few more people.
So Rory says despite the pushback, she kept bringing race up in conversations and in her own writing.
She says even if she couldn't change people's minds, she wanted to at least plant the seed.
We're told over and over in the Torah to love the stranger because we were the stranger. As Jews, we know what it means to have laws that have been instituted against us purely based on religion. We know what it means to have people think less of us because of our religion, because of narratives that have been created around us. We know what it means to be forced to live in certain areas. We know what it means not to have access to education and jobs in the same way. And so what does that mean then as a Jewish community who now have a certain degree of success? We still have poverty in our community. We still have problems. What does it mean as a community to have another community say to us, we are being systematically oppressed? How do we as a Jewish community say, no, you're making that up? How do we not say, I've heard that story before and I know that that story can exist. I know that it could be true. It's hard for us because it never happened to us in America. And so we want to think that America is not capable of it. But we know what it means to have a society that's established around privileging a group of people over another. And so that was always what I wanted the story to be. It was always about, we as a Jewish community have a responsibility here to ask ourselves these questions and to think about what's going on and to push back on it.
Eventually, preaching from the pulpit just wasn't enough.
Rory went to the streets, participating in protests after Ferguson.
And during one of those events, she was arrested.
How did your congregation respond when you got arrested?
Not necessarily as well as I had hoped. Within the congregation itself, maybe some division around it. I think partially because of how the conversations about race were starting to become difficult for people. And partially also because it's scary for people to think that your clergy could just go around getting arrested for anything without you knowing about it. And so that was really, I think, more of the concern started to really be, how do we make sure that this wasn't, my new thing wasn't going to be to just go out and get myself arrested all of the time. there was a little bit of some comforting that had to happen. And for some people, it's incredibly energizing and incredibly pride-filling to see their clergy out on the streets living what they're preaching, praying with their feet, as Abraham Joshua Heschel said. But for others, it's incredibly scary because who knows what I could have said and what I could have done next.
This actually takes us back to Reverend Dan from the top of the show. He's the one who got some pushback after putting a Black Lives Matter sign outside his church.
He says what comes across as fear could actually be something else.
There's a grieving process that happens when we confront uncomfortable realities. We've seen it. We've seen denial. We've seen anger. I think right now probably a lot of people are in the middle of bargaining. But it's the same grieving process as you go for any kind of feeling of loss. And in this case, it's the loss of the feeling that, you know, we solved this problem. The All Lives Matter crowd mean what they say. And many of them see the language of Black Lives Matter as divisive because when you say Black Lives Matter, they feel uncomfortable. And it's natural to say, well, the thing that somebody's saying is what's making me uncomfortable. And, of course, what's really underneath that is the inequities in society. And Black Lives Matter isn't divisive. Racism and privilege are divisive.
I want to go back to your blog post. After you wrote that person back, did they reply?
No, I never heard back. I think the most powerful thing that happened to me because of that letter was that I got that on Christmas Eve last year, a young teenager in the congregation who was an African-American teenager who we hadn't seen for a long time. She wasn't really interested in our youth group activities, wasn't really interested in coming, getting up in the morning and coming to services. But she came to Christmas Eve services with her mother. And she told me that she had been making Black Lives Matter signs and T-shirts at her school and doing activism. But the principal of the school had told her, you should say All Lives Matter. So when the 16-year-old told her teacher about that, the teacher handed her a printed piece of paper. It had my little blog post on being asked to change Black Lives Matter to All Lives Matter, and said, read this, and this is what you should tell the principal. She got all the way to the bottom and then said, wait a minute, that's my church. That's my minister. And it was the greatest gift in the world to know that one person who I knew and who had watched grown up and who seemed to be drifting from us, but she felt valued and she felt heard and she felt encouraged in her path of social justice and activism. Now that is an amazing response to something like this.
We need to make a programming note that you can think of this show as the end of season one of We Live Here. And I gotta say, when we got started, we didn't know that this was gonna last for longer than a year, that there would be, we'd be saying things like the end of season one, which implies there will be more than this, and there will be, right?
There will be,
a lot more.
Yeah, we're excited. So we've got a lot of good stuff planned for next year, but that also means that Tim and I need to take a couple weeks off to do some reporting.
Right, we'll be back in late February with a whole new season of We Live Here. We'll have a brand new website, too. We'll be doing
more
a lot
on social media.
Way more on social media. We'll be talking to you guys more. There will be events. So, but again, thanks to everyone who made season one great and who talked to us for this show when we were just getting started and we said, hey, we've got this podcast thing. You should come talk to us. Thank you so much. It's been a great experience. And We Live Here is produced by me. Oh, and
Cheesy
Pugs.
So it's time for your favorite part of the show, Cheesy Pugs, what we call Cheesy Plugs. Anyway, you know the deal. If you like the show, share it with everybody you know, your mama, your boyfriend, your daddy, your dog, and then go to iTunes, subscribe, and rate us. We really like the 5 stars. But yeah, hang with us and share us everywhere you know.
Right, and again, you can follow us on Twitter at WeLiveHereSTL. We tweet all kinds of stuff about the shows we're working on. Little bits of information as we find them. Again, that's on Twitter at WeLiveHereSTL. Okay, We Live Here is produced by me, Tim Lloyd.
And me, Camille Stanley.
Shula Newman is our editor, and Margie Fry Vogel is the editor of St. Louis Public Radio. We should make a note here that Margie is retiring at the end of this month. Thank you, Margie, for all the support that you gave to,
yes,
to We Live
Here.
Yes,
thank you so much.
Yeah, and helping shepherd this whole newsroom through some very, very tough reporting. Thank you very, very much.
Our theme music was composed by Cassie Morgan.
And from St. Louis Public Radio, this is We Live Here.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.